Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. An old-fashioned story by Jane Mayhall. When Clorinda's letter came, Jackie was 14. The idea of having a memory had just begun to be exotic. You could remember, and it was a feeling of conceit, an aberration, a limitless, unfixed disguise that made things seem what they were not. Would you know yourself as once you might have been? Jackie tapped the letter on her tooth and let the voluptuous sensation of Clorinda envelop vast, roomy mirrors outside the commonplace. That was dippy thinking and dead end. In plain terms, they had not met since they were 7. Both were now 14. There was something embarrassing, mawkish, too realistic about the years that divided. But as Jackie still felt that every friend was the big experience, hotshot soulmate, precociously admitted, the arrow is always pointing to your own self-interests, she could afford to give in a little to childish sentiment. There was much to be gained, and the thought that Clorinda still wanted to see her. After all these years, Jackie plowing through her life in the same old place, not quite Middle South, and Clorinda off on unknown rounds in Terre Haute, Indiana. Clorinda did not send a photograph, and she invited Jackie to come visit next week. Jackie's stomach slightly turned. To think that Clorinda would have grown taller, slimmer, blonder, curly-headeder. Jackie reconstructed Clorinda's elfin features. Secretly, she was the elf of the second grade. As Jackie was the black cat tiger, Clorinda, tiny in sprigs of golden curls, and Jackie was a suave black tiger. They were both little white girls in a white girl neighborhood, but that was the part that Jackie played. She didn't figure why. Clorinda was light and pixie with a husky pixie voice, and Jackie was the black cat river. Tigers in rivers and skulking underground. Clorinda danced and Jackie swam, but they complimented each other, knowing it very well. "Do you want to go?" said Jackie's mother. "I wonder what Mr. Harper is doing." "What did he do?" said Jackie. "I remember he ran trains." "He was an engineer on the LNN, I think." "Mrs. Harper, I remember her, was plenty tall." "Yes," said Jackie's mother. "She was raw-boned, gaunt, but attractive in her way." Jackie said, "Clorinda was pretty. And the boy, wasn't he younger?" "Yes, Kevin. He was one of those children whose face looks as if it never fits together, probably changed by now." "Yes." "Do you," said Jackie's mother, "want to go?" "Yes." Jackie's stomach gave the same unpleasant heave. It was like seeing something perfect in your mind that was going to happen outside. She didn't know if she could face it. Another way to think was nothing ever changed. Clorinda in the playfield in a starched lavender-flowered dress. The tiny, dainty, thin, dainty legs as she ran up to catch a volleyball toss. Clorinda had always reminded of morning glories strung on the wire school fence. Memory again, and Jackie could feel contemptuous of herself. The silly, childish past. What did Clorinda know about boys? She did not know about boys and how they smelled and tasted. Chewing gum lips and the flat buckles on their skinny leather belts. Clorinda didn't know about chasing in the alley and the sly electric welcome of fingers slightly touching, grabbing around and everybody running off again. Jackie held back, not only to entice the flood that was finally coming. At this age, of course, she depended on her own hypocrisy. She recognized to what uses she put it, deciding for a little while longer to play it safe. She had her technique and time enough for later. Clorinda did not know any of this yet. She knew nothing about Jackie. Their letters never said. Jackie anticipated for a moment, unfolding her own deepest, most wry cleverness to show off her experience and prowess. For Clorinda's piquant wonder, the shining elfin eyes which Jackie overwhelmingly recalled were gray. The contempt for her own true-heartedness came back. You get along in this world only by denying what you felt. That was one of the tricky rules, meanwhile snatching when you could one fast drink of feeling when nobody watched or knew. She stood at the table quizzically and gave her mother a disinterested smile. "Sure," she said, "I'd like to go, even if I don't like Clorinda or she thinks I'm a bore." Mechanical phrases sealed the issue. "I'll just go along for the trip." The next week Jackie was on the bus. Out of her suitcase she sneaked a homemade sausage sandwich wrapped in wax paper and a German sour pickle. This was a period in America when some people could not afford bus station snacks, but it wasn't considered respectable to bring your own. Goodbye. Farewell. Jackie had given strict orders against her mother that she not be accompanied by any family person. Goodbye. Farewell. The bus jiggled along, tears formed in the hot corners of her eyes. Jackie was not much used to travel and led a sheltered life, but more due to money lack than cowardly inhibition. Jackie felt sorry for her parents who never had a break, but now let their undeserving daughter take a 4-day fling. Phooey, rat, hell, bitch. A string of off-color words flattered her into composure. Rat, phooey, hell. She gobbled the sour pickle. Her thoughts reverted to Clorinda, then were lost in the yellow-green spring countryside. There were a few men on the bus, too middle-aged to be interesting, although this idea was just a pose, and if Jackie looked at some man with crossed knees long enough, she could imagine actively putting the palms of her hands on his legs. She tried to curb herself, but could not stop thinking what she liked to. Getting her hands around the lovely meated knees, and also squeezing his wrists and elbows, and kissing the harsh, smooth-shaven cheeks of men. Often these attacks of desire could nearly swallow up reason, as, when she was a little child, she liked to hug a tree. When the bus stopped at Terre Haute, Clorinda and her younger brother were waiting. Jackie was not surprised. It was a funny thing, and she let the fact sink in. She recognized Clorinda by not recognizing her. She knew she would be changed, and Jackie let the galloping, uneasy feeling simply run over her for a moment. She felt remorse, too, the way you feel guilty for being mean. Clorinda was no longer pretty. She was absolutely glumpy and stood on the platform, peering with large, bespectacled eyes. What had been elfin had turned into raw bones. Maybe not so bad, but it matched somebody else. Her blonde hair had darkened, and the light, freckled skin was just mottled, drab. She and Kevin waved. Jackie dragged over her suitcase. Kevin was about her height, still a little boy, but Clorinda was a big, bungling woman. "Did you know me?" asked Jackie. "Sort of." Clorinda examined her with slow, incurious eyes, which at first looked too big, popped. Jackie searched for her beauty. Defiance made her do it, like being determined to put a picture back in its frame. If she said that, would Clorinda know what she meant? She felt a hovering indecision, whether or not to trust, as it used to be, how the other thought, no matter what. She could not find a way to speak the subject. "I knew you," said Jackie. "Mother is at home. She said to take a taxi." The town was like a movie that seemed strange. All the time the three of them walked, aiming for a taxi, Kevin lugging the bag, Jackie had this double vision. It was like everything you knew was building up and disappearing, a kind of idea she had just come on recently. Unexpected developments, and Jackie loved thinking in these terms, but could leave it alone if she wanted. Clorinda wore a print dress with a white collar around the gawky neck. She was at an awkward age, Jackie's mother would say. Jackie had never grown any taller past the age of 11, but was not quite a runt and normal short. They had plenty to talk about, Clorinda asking about the trip. At the same time, she seemed cagey and remote. That was what caused the strangeness, or maybe it was her different appearance. Still, somewhere in that big, ungainly girl was a shiny little drop of elfin gold. Mrs. Harper welcomed Jackie. She asked about Jackie's mother and father. Only Mrs. Harper, Jackie could estimate, was definitely real. It was not that she looked exactly the same as she did 7 years ago. Jackie had no memory for other people's mothers, but it was how red and slightly flushed Mrs. Harper's face was. That made her seem real and the nub of some experience Jackie didn't have to embroider on. Mrs. Harper sat down earnestly and asked what she and her mother and father had been doing all these years. Jackie said that her father still had his lumberyard job over at Kretschmer's. Her mother stuck around the house doing housework. Jackie rattled on, everything feeling important that she mentioned. "What have you been doing?" Jackie said, "I play the violin, but not very good." Privately, she thought she did better, but it was not a thing to say. Mrs. Harper nodded, the perfect audience. All the news was taken right. Kevin stood shyly in the corner. It was true his face had not yet come together. His gray eyes were too wide, and the tufted brown hair made the skull seem lopsided. He was gallantly aware of not being usual-looking, but Kevin kept himself a gentleman and was not going to get mad at what other people thought. These ideas flitted through Jackie's mind. Clorinda sat on the divan, and Jackie noticed how thoroughly a woman she was. Clorinda looked about 18. Neither of the girls wanted to make an effort to live up to the past. Any references to or images of what Jackie might have considered before shriveled in her head like burnt paper. As soon as they were alone in the guest room, Kevin's, and Lent for the visit, Clorinda said, "Jackie, do you have any dates?" "Yes, my mother lets me. Yours?" Behind the glasses, Clorinda rolled sophisticated eyes. "Sure, what else is there?" Jackie had a slight sense of distaste. Why? In the double-track way, her mind crossed over again. She felt she had to protect the 7-year-old elf that Clorinda was from the big, gangling woman she'd become. Thinking like that wasn't just dumb, it was crazy. "I got a couple of dates lined up for you," Clorinda said. What else should she have said? Nothing wrong with that, but Jackie felt faintly pressured, hemmed in. "Well," she said, "I'll see." "What do you mean? They're nice kids." "I know," said Jackie, her words vaporized. "I mean, all right." That night, Mrs. Harper cooked a chicken with creamed gravy and had green beans and then cherry tarts for dessert. The Harpers were not rich either and seemed even worse off than Jackie's people. Mr. Harper was sick and had been let go from his railroad job, only doing part-time work. But he still wore his railroad cap that Jackie remembered. She always thought he was not dressed up because he wore the gray-striped gingham cap inside the house. He had a sick-looking color and looked older than anybody Jackie had ever known. The change had made him very old. He sat down and belched. It was indigestion and not bad manners. Mrs. Harper handed him some medicine. Clorinda did not pay any attention to anybody. She sat at the table putting on fingernail polish, even a few seconds before supper was served. It seemed terrible and sordid, and Jackie had a chilly feeling. But also she was thrilled. People so badly off and everything running into like shabby poor folks acting. It was not really too awful or dangerous. Though just seeing things so badly off and the tablecloth with a hole neatly mended, that's the way it looked. This was not in Jackie's language yet, but she had a sense of the extravagant misery. It was a keen feeling of excitement that families got poor, and she was torn between her 14-year-old contempt and her inborn sense of importance about what people had to go through. Jackie didn't have the words for this either, but it was the spirit of the connoisseur. She was a little afraid of Mr. Harper, just because he was sick. She was afraid of people with whom she could not enter any give-and-take relation. Included, there was no possibility of feeling romantic about him. He was too sad and out of work. There was nobody to be in love with, really. Clorinda had changed too much, although Jackie kept looking for glints. But even Clorinda's movements had slowed down. She wore heavy high heels and had heavy woman's legs. The only thing that remained was her husky voice. "Mom, Jackie and I are going to the movies," she said to Mrs. Harper. "All right," said Mrs. Harper. "Jackie," she said, "I trust you to take care of Clorinda." That was funny. Clorinda was twice as big, but maybe Mrs. Harper sensed the same thing. Jackie was a suave old tiger self, and Clorinda had been nothing but a fairy, a Tinkerbell elf. She was clearly a dependent. Jackie tapped a front tooth with her fork. Maybe it was not loyal to Clorinda having this idea. But Jackie would always take care of her after all. When they were alone again, Clorinda said, "You don't think we're really going to the movies?" "I don't care," said Jackie. "Not the kids I know." "All right." Jackie was not as pleased as she might have been, but she was tired from the bus ride and was therefore not getting the right bang out of an opportunity offered. It was a big chance to be with boys. She never doubted that she was more than a little girl. She had never in her life felt like a child. It was Clorinda who'd been that, not herself. Jackie was always being canny and never innocent. And she played those games that were outlandish of testing memory. And she could be perfectly calm and see the world falling apart. And nobody, especially not Clorinda, could see how sick and old her father, Mr. Harper, was. However, even seeing matters clearly, Jackie did not like the way Clorinda talked about boys. It was a slow motion in how she moved her heavy legs, and everything was, for a moment, too unpleasantly in contrast to their grammar school days. She was walking on eggs of dreams. Clorinda set her hair, and Jackie went into the bathroom to wash her face. Mrs. Harper had hung up 2 towels and a small, clean, ragged washcloth. Jackie gritted her teeth, exulted. The sparseness and poverty of the bathroom felt enchanted. She frothed the soap in her hands and rubbed it over her face. In the mirror, she saw her own black, humorless, terribly observing eyes. She feared that Clorinda was too lethargic in her own ways to make Jackie any better or different. Jackie glimpsed that she had actually made the trip in the hope of improving herself. The boys came in a car. They must have been about 19 years old. There were two of them, big, dumb louts. As soon as Jackie saw them, she tried to imagine putting her hands on their knees. But they were so compulsively apish, with their swinging animal arms and leering smiles, their eyes dull-leaded, their souls, she felt, were composed of greasy soup. But they had a car, and their hair was slicked down. One boy was named Tom, and the other Red. Red was Clorinda's partner. They sat in the back seat, and before the car was 3 blocks away, they were locked in a writhing embrace. Jackie kept her eyes on the streets, passing unfamiliar corners. "Where are we going?" she said. "To get some beer, then a place in the woods," her own delegated lout said. Jackie felt a disapproval mixed with conscience. In spite of herself, what had she wanted? She knew. What she'd wanted was grown-up laughing and talking like in Scott Fitzgerald. This, where she was also different from the magic feeling of boys grabbing in the alley. They, at least, were friendly. The silence in the car was deadening. From the rear seat came the sound of kisses and rustling. Tom, her front seat lout, reached over and yanked at Jackie's skirt. "Cut it out," Jackie said. "What's the matter, you yellow?" Inwardly, she swore never to go out with anybody under 30. Older people were more polite. Her mind ticked regulations. But in fact, Jackie might have guessed, and maybe it was Clorinda's lousy crowd. That was what Terre Haute boys were like. "No, I'm not yellow." "Then what are you?" "I'm somebody," the words tumbled out scathing. "I'm somebody that can't stand big apes." "Why, you filthy." Jackie had always enjoyed the curse words that bubbled up in her head, but hearing them said aloud and directed at her character was something else. A stream was let loose. She didn't even know him, and he was talking vicious as he could. The boy was driving faster and faster. She did not feel she ought to have kept quiet. She only hoped, though, she could get out before the car turned over. She didn't even know him. In the back seat, the other couple necked, oblivious. "Pull over," said Jackie. The boy drove on. Jackie's mind worked like a piston. "Okay," she said. "Pardon me what I said. If you slow down, I'll act like you wanted." "Huh." He appeared disconcerted by the change, but he said, "You'd better." The boy eased his foot on the gas. At the same time, he was sullen. "You Southern girls are too damn stuck up." "Oh," said Jackie, "we're not that much. I just didn't know how to do." "Up here," said Tom, "girls are good for just one thing. You know what that is." "Sure," Jackie said. She felt an ecstasy of hate. "When you come down to it, I guess you're right." They stopped at what looked like a main corner, waiting for a light. Jackie put her hand on the door handle and got out. In a flash, she was safe on the sidewalk. "Now," her companion sneered, "what's up?" "Thanks," she said. "I gotta go back." Clorinda was pulling out of her sleepy involvement. She put a disheveled head at the window. "Jackie," she said, "what's the matter?" "Nothing," said Jackie. "I'm just tired. You all go along. I'll get back. See you, Clorinda, in the morning." "What? Well, I think you're nuts." "Yes, I am." "Crap," said Tom. "She's a bitch. There's nothing I hate more than a bitch and a tease. You're the kind of girl that can make a man sick." "Okay," said Jackie. "See you, Clorinda." She stifled false apologies. "Well," Clorinda put her head back down in the car, "I think you're nuts." Jackie walked off. The car did not even pause. Ahead, it went in second gear. Jackie for a moment felt relieved, but the next instant she opened her pocketbook, and into it, having swiftly removed wallet and lipstick, she was expertly sick. Nobody apparently noticed. The sky was half dark, and everybody walking along was busy, heading for a movie or a store. Jackie took a streetcar to Clorinda's address. The motorman said where to transfer, and it was not very long. Her face, she felt, was either green or white. Mrs. Harper was sitting on the porch. She did not act like anything was wrong. "I see," she said, "you decided to come back." "Yes," said Jackie, "I was sick." Mrs. Harper did not comment. But Jackie kept the pocketbook out of sight until she reached the bathroom. Then she found some old Dutch cleanser and set about her job. It was pretty hard cleaning all the gunk out of the lining. Jackie felt perfectly well and calm. Why did she ever throw up? When the task was done, she returned to the guest room. Kevin was bunking on the sofa in the parlor, and the Harpers had a bedroom down the hall. Clorinda's private quarters was a back porch renovated and not big enough for two with any comfort. Jackie put on her pajamas and climbed into the small brown wooden bed. The clean sheets felt clean, with a nice blanket piled on. She had to clear her mind and get some needed rest. Jackie didn't know how much later, but Clorinda had opened the door. A slant of light went across the wall. "Hey, you still awake?" Jackie said, "I don't know. What's the trouble?" Clorinda shut the door and came in. She said, "Don't turn on the light." "I won't." Clorinda said, "Oh, well, turn it on." "I don't know where it is." Clorinda breathed around a little and clicked a lamp. Jackie said, "What happened?" "Nothing. You nearly ruined it. But Tom gave Red the car. We went on anyway." "I'm glad." Clorinda sat in silence. What she rested on was like a cedar chest, and her profile was rising out of bulky shadows. She had her glasses off, and the big pop eyes looked naked. Jackie felt a twinge. She didn't know at what. Clorinda's bunched-up clothes and hair seemed unprotected, though her manner was cold, officious. "You want to hear something?" Jackie said. "Sure. I've got caught." "What's?" Clorinda turned, full on. "You know what that means." Jackie sank, abashed. The waves of the other girl's wrath went over her. "Yes, I guess I do." "Don't you guess? You know." Jackie felt astonished, but the way it was happening was also very cold. Clorinda's face was immobile in satisfaction. "Now I've got them where they're going to be." "Who?" Jackie propped herself on elbows. "Clorinda, who?" "Don't call me Clorinda. Nobody calls your other name." Clorinda's voice mimicked the wayside problem. "It's Jackie, Jackie, but not me. Why do I be called this?" Jackie listened carefully. It was like figuring out pig Latin. There was something flipping back or in between. She ought to circumvent the troublemaking places. She said, "Yes, okay. I don't like Jacqueline either. I'll call anything you want." Clorinda shot a bitter glance, in charge of herself again. She said she hadn't told Red, but was going to. Even if it wasn't him. She spat her feelings, jerky. Jackie accepted the way she talked. It was like taking things in through a sieve, not what you could put your mind on all at once. But Clorinda was testing her own courage, saying what she needed. What Jackie spoke was not her real train of thought. She said, "You going to tell your mother?" Clorinda looked at her blankly. "Sure, she probably knows." "Will?" Clorinda gave a little laugh. "Don't worry, I can wind her around my little finger." The main thing was, though, she was going to tell her dad. He'd be plenty upset. Upset wasn't what Clorinda used. Jackie could almost hear the thinking, better than words uttered. Clorinda's thoughts overflowed, and you couldn't hold them back. Mr. Harper would have it out with Red, and they'd have to get married. Jackie said, "You want to get married? Now?" "You bet your life I do." In the tone, there was no answer. But everything that Jackie had ever pipe-dreamed about felt shrunk up. All of her expectations were a cause for self-distrust. Even if things like memories never quite came to the surface, tigers and elves and all that mushy stuff. Jackie's next question was a total giveaway. She felt in Clorinda the rebuff before she made it. Jackie said, "You still going back to school?" Clorinda said, "Heck no." She was done with that. School was a place for idiots. What good was going to school? She turned her bulging sad eyes straight on Jackie. Jackie felt the force. It was like a wheelbarrow emptying bricks. Jackie could not keep her gaze on the other girl's face. Nothing could be brought to terms, and it could not be summarized. By now, Jackie had had crushes on lots of teachers, and usually what they taught. Sports and mathematics, music, lab. But she sensed the violation toward her friends. It wasn't what you ought to feel. As there was also a vague connection with the boy she liked in alleys. It was a transgression that she couldn't tell. Doing the way you felt was always forbidden, but just assuming that frame of mind was indulgent and wrong. Considering the way that Clorinda felt, what Jackie liked, Clorinda hated. People could vanish from your life and maybe not come back, and yet Clorinda sat there like a big stuffed avenging angel. Was she in love with Red? It didn't matter to Clorinda, Jackie thought, if she was or not. The lamp seemed muddier, draining. Through the dimity curtains were shreds of dawn. Clorinda gave a yawn. She said, "How long are you going to stay?" Jackie said, "I don't know. I've got to go and do some things. I thought I might get a bus tomorrow. They gave a round trip back." Clorinda got up and lumbered toward the door. She said, "If Red don't marry me, my dad'll beat him up." Jackie almost did not say anything. The idea of Mr. Harper hitting anybody did not seem true. She said, "I hope," hesitating, "I hope he won't." Clorinda shifted her eyes pityingly. "We got different ideas. You want the light put out?" Jackie said yes. She pulled the covers up. She looked around the room after Clorinda left. By the bureau, she caught sight of something she'd noticed before. Kevin had cut out some newspaper pictures of dogs and tacked them on the wall. It didn't mean anything. Jackie felt submerged. Nothing would have helped, even if she'd been smart and called Clorinda another name. All that had been told seemed boring as the moon, and what Jackie had talked out, too. It didn't mean anything. She tried to wonder what it meant. It was like one of those old-fashioned stories that just went on, and nothing new to learn. Why was she going home? Jackie saw no point. There was no reason for going back, or to stay at Clorinda's either. There ought to be someplace else that wasn't here or home. And that story was An Old-Fashioned Story by Jane Mayhall from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. The Mezzotint by Montague Rhodes James. Some time ago, I believe I had the pleasure of telling you the story of an adventure which happened to a friend of mine by the name of Dennistown during his pursuit of objects of art for the museum at Cambridge. He did not publish his experiences very widely upon his return to England, but they cannot fail to become known to a good many of his friends, and among others to the gentleman who at that time presided over an art museum at another university. It was to be expected that the story should make a considerable impression on the mind of a man whose vocation lay in lines similar to Dennistown's, and that he should be eager to catch at any explanation of the matter which tended to make it seem improbable that he should ever be called upon to deal with so agitating an emergency. It was indeed somewhat consoling to him to reflect that he was not expected to acquire ancient manuscripts for his institution. That was the business of the Shelburnian Library. The authorities of that institution might, if they pleased, ransack obscure corners of the continent for such matters. He was glad to be obliged at the moment to confine his attention to enlarging the already unsurpassed collection of English topographical drawings and engravings possessed by his museum. Yet, as it turned out, even a department so homely and familiar as this may have its dark corners, and to one of these Mr. Williams was unexpectedly introduced. Those who have taken even the most limited interest in the acquisition of topographical pictures are aware that there is one London dealer whose aid is indispensable to their researches. Mr. J. W. Britnell publishes at short intervals very admirable catalogues of a large and constantly changing stock of engravings, plans, and old sketches of mansions, churches, and towns in England and Wales. These catalogues were, of course, the ABC of his subject to Mr. Williams. But as his museum already contained an enormous accumulation of topographical pictures, he was a regular rather than a copious buyer. And he rather looked to Mr. Britnell to fill up gaps in the rank and file of his collection than to supply him with rarities. Now, in February of last year, there appeared upon Mr. Williams' desk at the museum a catalogue from Mr. Britnell's emporium, and accompanying it was a typewritten communication from the dealer himself. This latter ran as follows. "Dear Sir, we beg to call your attention to number 978 in our accompanying catalogue, which we shall be glad to send on approval. Yours faithfully, J. W. Britnell." To turn to number 978 in the accompanying catalogue was with Mr. Williams, as he observed to himself, the work of a moment, and in the place indicated he found the following entry. 978. Unknown. Interesting mezzotint. View of a manor house, early part of the century, 15 by 10 inches, black frame, £2, 2 shillings. It was not specially exciting, and the price seemed high. However, as Mr. Britnell, who knew his business and his customer, seemed to set store by it, Mr. Williams wrote a postcard asking for the article to be sent on approval, along with some other engravings and sketches which appeared in the same catalog. And so he passed without much excitement of anticipation to the ordinary labors of the day. A parcel always arrives a day later than you expected, and that of Mr. Britnell proved, as I believe the phrase goes, no exception to the rule. It was delivered at the museum by the afternoon post of Saturday, after Mr. Williams had left his work, and it was accordingly brought round to his rooms in college by the attendant, in order that he might not have to wait over Sunday before looking through it, and returning such of the contents as he did not propose to keep. And here he found it when he came in to tea with a friend. The only item with which I'm concerned was the rather large, black-framed mezzotint of which I've already quoted the short description given in Mr. Britnell's catalogue. Some more details of it will have to be given, though I cannot hope to put before you the look of the picture as clearly as it is present to my own eye. Very nearly the exact duplicate of it may be seen in a good many old inn parlors or in the passages of undisturbed country mansions at the present moment. It was a rather indifferent mezzotint, and an indifferent mezzotint is, perhaps, the worst form of engraving known. It presented a full-face view of a not very large manor house of the last century, with three rows of plain-sashed windows with rusticated masonry about them, a parapet with balls or vases at the angles, and a small portico in the center. On either side were trees, and in front a considerable expanse of lawn. The legend A.W.F. Sculpsit was engraved on the narrow margin, and there was no further inscription. The whole thing gave the impression that it was the work of an amateur. What in the world Mr. Britnell could mean by affixing the price of £2 2s to such an object was more than Mr. Williams could imagine. He turned it over with a good deal of contempt. Upon the back was a paper label, the left-hand half of which had been torn off. All that remained were the ends of two lines of writing. The first had the letters Engley Hall, the second Sex. It would, perhaps, be just worthwhile to identify the place represented, which he could easily do with the help of a gazetteer, and then he would send it back to Mr. Britnell, with some remarks reflecting upon the judgment of that gentleman. He lighted the candles, for it was now dark, made the tea, and supplied the friend with whom he had been playing golf, for I believe the authorities of the university I write of indulge in that pursuit by way of relaxation, and tea was taken to the accompaniment of a discussion which golfing persons can imagine for themselves, but which the conscientious writer has no right to inflict upon any non-golfing persons. The conclusion arrived at was that certain strokes might have been better, and that in certain emergencies neither player had experienced that amount of luck which a human being has a right to expect. It was now that the friend, let us call him Professor Binks, took up the framed engraving and said, "What's this place, Williams?" "Just what I'm going to try to find out," said Williams, going to the shelf for a gazetteer. "Look at the back. Somethingly Hall, either in Sussex or Essex. Half the name's gone, you see. You don't happen to know it, I suppose." "It's from that man Britnell, I suppose, isn't it?" said Binks. "Is it for the museum?" "Well, I think I should buy it if the price was 5 shillings, said Williams, "but for some unearthly reason he wants 2 guineas for it. I can't conceive why. It's a wretched engraving, and there aren't even any figures to give it life." "It's not worth 2 guineas, I should think," said Binks, "but I don't think it's so badly done. The moonlight seems rather good to me, and I should have thought there were figures, or at least a figure just on the edge in front." "Let's look," said Williams. "Well, it's true the light is rather cleverly given. Where's your figure?" "Oh, yes, just the head in the very front of the picture." And indeed there was, hardly more than a black blot on the extreme edge of the engraving, the head of a man or a woman, a good deal muffled up, the back turned to the spectator and looking towards the house. Williams had not noticed it before. "Still," he said, "though it's a cleverer thing than I thought, I can't spend 2 guineas of museum money on a picture of a place I don't know." Professor Binks had his work to do and soon went, and very nearly up to hall time Williams was engaged in a vain attempt to identify the subject of his picture. If the vowel before the NG had only been left, it would have been easy enough, he thought. But as it is, the name may be anything from Guestingly to Langley, And there are many more names ending like this than I thought, and this rotten book has no index of terminations. Hall and Mr. Williams' college was at 7. It need not be dwelt upon, the less so as he met their colleagues who had been playing golf during the afternoon, and words with which we have no concern were freely bandied across the table. Merely golfing words, I would hasten to explain. I suppose an hour or more to have been spent in what is called common room after dinner. Later in the evening, some few retired to Williams' rooms, and I have little doubt that whist was played and tobacco smoked. During a lull in these operations, Williams picked up the mezzotint from the table without looking at it and handed it to a person mildly interested in art, telling him where it had come from and the other particulars which we already know. The gentleman took it carelessly, looked at it, then said in a tone of some interest, "It's really a very good piece of work, Williams. It has quite a feeling of the Romantic period. The light is admirably managed, it seems to me, and the figure, though it's rather too grotesque, is somehow very impressive." "Yes, isn't it?" said Williams, who was just then busy giving whiskey and soda to others of the company, and was unable to come across the room to look at the view again. It was by this time rather late in the evening, and the visitors were on the move. After they went, Williams was obliged to write a letter or two and clear up some odd bits of work. At last, some time past midnight, he was disposed to turn in, and he put out his lamp after lighting his bedroom candle. The picture lay face upwards on the table where the last man who looked at it had put it, and it caught his eye as he turned the lamp down. What he saw made him very nearly drop the candle on the floor, and he declares now that if he had been left in the dark at that moment he would have had a fit. But as that did not happen, he was able to put down the light on the table and take a good look at the picture. It was indubitable, rankly impossible, no doubt, but absolutely certain. In the middle of the lawn, in front of the unknown house, there was a figure where no figure had been at 5 o'clock that afternoon. It was crawling on all fours towards the house, and it was muffled in a strange black garment with a white cross on the back. I do not know what is the ideal course to pursue in a situation of this kind. I can only tell you what Mr. Williams did. He took the picture by one corner and carried it across the passage to a second set of rooms which he possessed. There he locked it up in a drawer, closed the doors of both sets of rooms, and retired to bed. But first he wrote out and signed an account of the extraordinary change which the picture had undergone since it had come into his possession. Sleep visited him rather late, but it was consoling to reflect that the behavior of the picture did not depend upon his own unsupported testimony. Evidently the man who had looked at it the night before had seen something of the same kind as he had, otherwise he might have been tempted to think that something gravely wrong was happening, either to his eyes or his mind. This possibility being fortunately precluded, two matters awaited him on the morrow. He must take stock of the picture very carefully and call in a witness for the purpose, and he must make a determined effort to ascertain what house it was that was represented. He would therefore ask his neighbor Nisbet to breakfast with him, and he would subsequently spend a morning over the Gazetteer. Nisbet was disengaged and arrived about 9:30. His host was not quite dressed, even at this late hour. During breakfast, nothing was said about the mezzotint by Williams, save that he had a picture on which he wished for Nisbet's opinion. But those who are familiar with university life can picture the wide and delightful range of subjects over which the conversation of two fellows of Canterbury College is likely to extend during a Sunday morning breakfast. Hardly a topic was left unchallenged, from golf to lawn tennis. Yet I'm bound to say that Williams was rather distraught, for his interest naturally centered in that very strange picture which was now reposing, face downwards, in the drawer in the room opposite. The morning pipe was at last lighted, and the moment had arrived for which he looked. With very considerable, almost tremulous excitement, he ran across, unlocked the drawer, and, extracting the picture, still face downwards, ran back and put it into Nisbet's hands. "Now," he said, "Nisbet, I want you to tell me exactly what you see in that picture. Describe it, if you don't mind, rather minutely. I'll tell you why afterwards." "Well," said Nisbet, "I have here a view of a country house, English, I presume, by moonlight." "Moonlight? You're sure of that?" "Certainly. The moon appears to be on the wane, if you wish for details, and there are clouds in the sky." "All right, go on. I'll swear, added Williams in an aside, there was no moon when I saw it first. Well, there's not much more to be said, Nisbet continued. The house has 1, 2, 3 rows of windows, 5 in each row, except at the bottom, where there's a porch instead of the middle one, and... But what about figures, said Williams, with marked interest. There aren't any, said Nisbet, but... What? No figure on the grass in front? Not a thing. You'll swear to that? Certainly I will, but there's just one other thing. What? Why, one of the windows on the ground floor, left of the door, is open. Is it really so? My goodness, he must have got in, said Williams with great excitement, and he hurried to the back of the sofa on which Nisbet was sitting, and catching the picture from him, verified the matter for himself. It was quite true. There was no figure, and there was the open window. Williams, after a moment of speechless surprise, went to the writing table and scribbled for a short time. Then he brought 2 papers to Nisbet, and asked him first to sign one. It was his own description of the picture, which you have just heard, and then to read the other, which was Williams' statement written the night before. What can it all mean? Said Nisbet. Exactly. Well, one thing I must do, or 3 things, now I think of it. I must find out from Garwood, this was his last night's visitor, what he saw, and then I must get the thing photographed before it goes further, and then I must find out what the place is. I can do the photographing myself, said Nisbet, and I will. But you know, it looks very much as if we were assisting at the working out of a tragedy somewhere. The question is, has it happened already, or is it going to come off? You must find out what the place is. Yes, he said, looking at the picture again. I expect you're right. He has got in. And if I don't mistake, there'll be devil to pay in one of the rooms upstairs. I'll tell you what, said Williams. I'll take the picture across to old Green. This was a senior fellow of the college who had been bursar for many years. It's quite likely he'll know it. We have property in Essex and Sussex, and he must have been over the 2 counties a lot in his time. Quite likely he will, said Nisbet, but just let me take my photograph first. But look here, I rather think Green isn't up today. He wasn't in hall last night, and I think I heard him say he was going down for the Sunday. That's true, too, said Williams. I know he's gone to Brighton. Well, if you'll photograph it now, I'll go across to Garwood and get his statement, and you keep an eye on it while I'm gone. I'm beginning to think 2 guineas is not a very exorbitant price for it now. In a short time he had returned and brought Mr. Garwood with him. Garwood's statement was to the effect that the figure, when he had seen it, was clear of the edge of the picture, but had not got far across the lawn. He remembered a white mark on the back of its drapery, but could not have been sure it was a cross. A document to this effect was then drawn up and signed, and Nisbet proceeded to photograph the picture. "Now what do you mean to do?" he said. "Are you going to sit and watch it all day?" "Well, no, I think not," said Williams. "I rather imagine we're meant to see the whole thing. You see, between the time I saw it last night and this morning, there was time for lots of things to happen, but the creature only got into the house. It could easily have got through its business in the time and gone to its own place again. But the fact of the window being open, I think, must mean that it's in there now. So I feel quite easy about leaving it. And besides, I have a kind of idea that it wouldn't change much, if at all, in the daytime. We might go out for a walk this afternoon and come in to tea, or whenever it gets dark. I shall leave it out on the table here and close the door. My skip can get in, but no one else." The 3 agreed that this would be a good plan, and further, that if they spent the afternoon together, they would be less likely to talk about the business to other people, for any rumor of such a transaction as was going on would bring the whole of the Phasmatological Society about their ears. We may give them a respite until 5 o'clock. At or near that hour, the 3 were entering William's staircase. They were at first slightly annoyed to see that the door of his rooms was ajar, but in a moment it was remembered that on Sunday the skips came for orders an hour or so earlier than on weekdays. However, a surprise was awaiting them. The first thing they saw was the picture leaning up against a pile of books on the table as it had been left, and the next thing was William Skip seated on a chair opposite, gazing at it with undisguised horror. How was this? Mr. Filcher, the name is not my own invention, was a servant of considerable standing, and set the standard of etiquette to all his own college and to several neighboring ones, and nothing could be more alien to his practice than to be found sitting on his master's chair or appearing to take any particular notice of his master's furniture or pictures. Indeed, he seemed to feel this himself. He started violently when the three men were in the room and got up with a marked effort. Then he said, "I ask your pardon, sir, for taking such a freedom as to sit down." "Not at all, Robert," interposed Mr. Williams. "I was meaning to ask you some time what you thought of that picture." "Well, sir, of course I don't set up my opinion against yours, but it ain't the picture I should 'ang where my little girl could see it."
"Wouldn't you, Robert? Why not?"
"No, sir. Why, the poor child, I recollect once she see a door Bible with pictures not 'alf what that is, and we 'ad to set up with the 3 or 4 nights afterwards. If you'll believe me, and if she was to catch a sight of this skeleton here, and whatever it is, carrying off the poor baby, she would be in a taking. You know how it is with children, how nervous they get with a little thing and all. But what I should say, it don't seem a right picture to be laying about, sir. Not where anyone that's liable to be startled could come on it."
"Should you be wanting anything this evening, sir?"
"Thank you, sir." With these words, the excellent man went to continue the round of his masters, and you may be sure the gentleman whom he left lost no time in gathering round the engraving. There was the house, as before, under the waning moon and the drifting clouds. The window that had been open was shut, and the figure was once more on the lawn, but not this time crawling cautiously on hands and knees. Now it was erect and stepping swiftly with long strides towards the front of the picture. The moon was behind it, and the black drapery hung down over its face so that only hints of that could be seen, and what was visible made the spectators profoundly thankful that they could see no more than the white dome-like forehead and a few straggling hairs. The head was bent down, and the arms were tightly clasped over an object which could be dimly seen and identified as a child. Whether dead or living, it was not possible to say. The legs of the appearance alone could be plainly discerned, and they were horribly thin. From 5 to 7, the three companions sat and watched the picture by turns, but it never changed. They agreed at last that it would be safe to leave it, and that they would return after Hall and await further developments. When they assembled again at the earliest possible moment, the engraving was there, but the figure was gone, and the house was quiet under the moonbeams. There was nothing for it but to spend the evening over gazetteers and guidebooks. Williams was a lucky one at last, and perhaps he deserved it. At 11:30 p.m. he read from Murray's Guide to Essex the following lines. 16.5 miles, Anningley. The church has been an interesting building of Norman date, but was extensively classicized in the last century. It contains the tomb of the family of Francis, whose mansion, Anglingley Hall, a solid Queen Anne house, stands immediately beyond the churchyard in a park of about 80 acres. The family is now extinct, the last heir having disappeared mysteriously in infancy in the year 1802. The father, Mr. Arthur Francis, was locally known as a talented amateur engraver in mezzotint. After his son's disappearance, he lived in complete retirement at the Hall, and was found dead in his studio on the 3rd anniversary of the disaster, having just completed an engraving of the house, impressions of which are of considerable rarity. This looked like business, and indeed Mr. Green, on his return, at once identified the house as Anningley Hall. "Is there any kind of explanation of the figure, Green?" was the question which Williams naturally asked. "I don't know, I'm sure, Williams. What used to be said in the place when I first knew it, which was before I came up here, was just this. Old Francis was always very much down on these poaching fellows, and whenever he got a chance he used to get a man whom he suspected of it turned off the estate, and by degrees he got rid of them all but one. Squires could do a lot of things then that they daren't think of now. Well, this man that was left was what you find pretty often in that country, the last remains of a very old family. I believe they were lords of the manor at one time. I recollect just the same thing in my own parish."
"Like the man in Tess of the D'Urbervilles," Williams put in.
"Yes, I dare say. It's not a book I could ever read myself. But this fellow could show a row of tombs in the church there that belonged to his ancestors, and all that went to sour him a bit.
but Francis, they said, could never get at him. He always kept just on the right side of the law, until one night the keepers found him at it in a wood right at the end of the estate. I could show you the place now. It marches with some land that used to belong to an uncle of mine. And you can imagine there was a row, and this man Gaudy, that was a name to be sure, Gaudy, I thought I should get it, Gaudy, he was unlucky enough, poor chap, to shoot a keeper. Well, that was what Francis wanted, and grand juries, you know what they would have been then, and poor Gaudy was strung up in double quick time, and I've been shown the place he was buried in on the north side of the church. You know the way in that part of the world. Anyone that's been hanged or made way with themselves, they bury them that side. And the idea was that some friend of Gaudy's, not a relation, because he had none, poor devil, he was the last of his line, kind of spes ultima gentis, must have planned to get hold of Francis's boy and put an end to his line, too. I don't know, it's rather an out-of-the-way thing for an Essex poacher to think of, but I should say now it looks more as if old Gaudy had managed the job himself. I hate to think of it. Have some whiskey, Williams. The facts were communicated by Williams to Dennistown, and by him to a mixed company, of which I was one, and the Sadducean professor of ophthalmology another. I am sorry to say that the latter, when asked what he thought of it, only remarked, "Oh, those Bridgeford people will say anything," a sentiment which met with the reception it deserved. I have only to add that the picture is now in the Ashleyan Museum, that it has been treated to discover whether sympathetic ink has been used in it, but without effect, that Mr. Britnell knew nothing of it save that he was sure it was uncommon, and that though carefully watched it has never been known to change again. And that story was The Mezzo Tint by Montague Rhodes James from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. No One's a Mystery by Elizabeth Talent. For my 18th birthday, Jack gave me a 5-year diary with a latch and a little key, light as a dime. I was sitting beside him scratching at the lock, which didn't seem to want to work, when he thought he saw his wife's Cadillac in the distance coming towards us. He pushed me down onto the dirty floor of the pickup and kept one hand on my head while he inhaled the musk of his cigarettes in the dashboard ashtray and sang along with Roseanne Cash on the tape deck. We'd been drinking tequila and the bottle was between his legs, resting up against his crotch where the seam of his Levi's was bleached linen white, though the Levi's were nearly new. I don't know why his Levi's always bleached like that, along the seams and at the knees. In a curve of cloth his zipper glinted gold. "It's her," he said. "She keeps the lights on in the daytime. I can't think of a single habit in a woman that irritates me more than that." When he saw that I was going to stay still, he took his hand from my head and ran it through his own dark hair. "Why does she?" I said. "She thinks it's safer. Why does she need to be safer? She's driving exactly 55 miles an hour. She believes in those signs. Speed monitored by aircraft. It doesn't matter that you can look up and see that the sky is empty." "She'll see your lips move, Jack. She'll know you're talking to someone. She'll think I'm singing along with the radio." He didn't lift his hand, just raised the fingers in salute while the pressure on his palm steadied the wheel, and I heard the Cadillac honk twice, musically. He was driving easily, 80 miles an hour. I studied his boots. The elk's heads stitched into the leather were bearded with frayed thread and the toes were scuffed, and there was a compact wedge of muddy manure between the heel and the sole, the same boots he'd been wearing for the 2 years I'd known him. On the tape deck, Roseanne Cash sang, "Nobody's into me, no one's a mystery." "Do you think she's getting famous because of who her daddy is or for herself?" Jack asked. "There are about 100 pop-tops on the floor. Did you know that? Some little kid could cut a bare foot on one of these, Jack." "No little kids get into this truck except for you. How come you let it get so dirty?" "How come?" he mocked. "You even sound like a kid. You can get back into the seat now if you want. She's not going to look over her shoulder and see you." "How do you know?" "I just know," he said, "like I know I'm going to get meatloaf for supper. It's in the air, like I know what you'll be writing in that diary." "What will I be writing?" I knelt on my side of the seat and craned around to look at the butterfly of dust printed on my jeans. Outside the window, Wyoming was dazzling in the heat. The wheat was fawn and yellow and parted smoothly by the thin dirt road. I could smell the water in the irrigation ditches hidden in the wheat. Tonight you'll write, "I love Jack. This is my birthday present from him. I can't imagine anybody loving anybody more than I love Jack." I can't. In a year you'll write, "I wonder what I ever really saw in Jack. I wonder why I spent so many days just riding around in his pickup. It's true he taught me something about sex. It's true there wasn't ever much else to do in Cheyenne." I won't write that. In 2 years you'll write, "I wonder what that old guy's name was, the one with the curly hair and the filthy, dirty pickup truck and time on his hands." I won't write that. No. Tonight I'll write, "I love Jack. This is my birthday present from him. I can't imagine anybody loving anybody more than I love Jack." "No, you can't," he said. "You can't imagine it." In a year I'll write, "Jack should be home any minute now. The table's set, my grandmother's linen and her old silver and the yellow candles left over from the wedding. But I don't know if I can wait until after the trout a la Navarra to make love to him." It must have been a fast divorce. In 2 years, I'll write, "Jack should be home by now. Little Jack is hungry for his supper. He said his first word today besides Mama and Papa. He said caca." Jack laughed. He was probably trying to finger paint the caca on the bathroom wall when you heard him say it. In 3 years, I'll write, "My nipples are a little sore from nursing Eliza Rosamund." Rosamund. Every little girl should have a middle name she hates. Her breath smells like vanilla and her eyes are just Jack's color of blue. "That's nice," Jack said. "So, which one do you like?" "I like yours," he said, "but I believe mine." "It doesn't matter. I believe mine." "Not in your heart of hearts, you don't. You're wrong." "I'm not wrong," he said. "And her breath would smell like your milk, and it's kind of a bittersweet smell if you want to know the truth." And that story was No One's a Mystery by Elizabeth Talent from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.